This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Last year, it was a stopgap budget. This year, lawmakers are considering what they call a lifeline budget to help higher ed and social services for just a few months.
I would like to throw a lifeline, but what I want to do is make sure that lifeline is truly going to help and stay afloat.
Bloomington State Representative Dan Brady was among the Republicans who voted no on the lifeline budget. He explains his position to GLT's Willis Kern. Laura Kennedy walks you through the new exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History on McLean County's deep ag roots. And during an edition of Grow, find out if you should be dumping your yard waste at the curb or reusing it. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's April 13th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Republicans in Springfield voted against the so-called lifeline budget that cleared the State House last week. The plan appropriates $815 million for things like homeless services, domestic violence programs, and MAP grants for low-income college students. One of those voting against the lifeline plan was Bloomington Republican Dan Brady. In this interview with GLT's Willis Kern, Brady says GOP members favor a full budget instead of a lifeline.
If we do this, we know we've already been told the governor's going to veto it. So let's stop playing those games. Let's continue to keep the negotiations going and try and find something. If it's not a full budget, as we now are into April, let's do something that's going to be more stabilized for a number of months, for in particular universities and human services, and let's make sure projected revenues are correct.
So if this is passed by the Democratic-controlled legislature and vetoed by the governor, as you say it will be, the Democrats don't hold a veto-proof majority anymore. Where do you expect all this to wind up?
Well, where I expect it to wind up, and I hope, as we are continuing to work, we in the House, developing our plan and taking parts of that grand bargain, if you will, from the Senate, we are cautiously optimistic that some of the parts of that that Governor Rauner has given a thumbs up to can be part of what we're working on and could be something much more stable and long term for those depending on a state budget. And I felt, in particular, as the representative for this district, as difficult as it is, sure, I would like to throw a lifeline, if you will. But what I want to do is make sure that lifeline is truly going to help and stay afloat. I don't want someone to believe a lifeline is going to be something and then that not produce anything as well. So those were a few of my concerns and as members of my caucus as well.
You and others in Springfield have been hailing pension reform as a key to solving the state's financial crisis for many years. Since the state Supreme Court struck down pension reform a couple of years ago, it's safe to say that all future reform efforts must only be targeted at future state employees and not the current ones. Is that how you see it?
Yes, that's how I see it. And I think we've come to that in the ongoing discussion of pensions. And one thing that has, I think, moved forward with pensions from when this monumental debate has started and different pieces of legislation has been passed and found unconstitutional, I don't think that we see the stakeholders pointing fingers as much anymore because they know the severity of this. What I see more is cooperative. All right, what can we do? We're not going to get everything. We know that. What is it we could all live with to stabilize our pension system? And I think I see that more than I've seen before when this issue started, the severity of it many, many years ago. And so that's encouraging. But we have a new pension plan out there that the House Republicans have filed. We believe that it does focus on what we think would be constitutional, past the constitutional muster, and that is in particular that it's not affecting existing retirees. It sets up different plans, but it tries to reduced down and tries to get some of the 800-pound gorilla, if you will, off the backs of what our investments are and what the operations are of the state of Illinois right now.
Beyond the budget, a couple of bills you're sponsoring this spring impact higher ed and Illinois State University. House Bill 3490 won unanimous House approval and is now in the Senate. It would expand scholarship options for nursing students at colleges and universities, public and private. In your release touting its passage, you're quoted as saying, to combat our nursing shortage, we need to find new ways to help, not hinder, those who want to make nursing their life's work. We spoke with ISU President Larry Dietz, who for the second time on this program refuted the notion that there is a nursing shortage. Here's what he said.
And lots of studies would not verify that. There are some shortages in some geographic areas, both in the urban center as well as centers of Illinois, as well as in some rural areas of Illinois. But there, overall, there is not a nursing shortage in Illinois.
So is this a solution in search of a problem?
Well, no. I think if you focus on what the legislation was and for, it's specifically for Masters of Science degrees in nursing, where there are shortages. It's my understanding in the review that we had. And so it's not just saying these are expanding, and what this does is it expands the number of schools that would have the opportunity for nursing scholarships, if you will, grants. But you have to stay focused on the fact that it's for Masters of Science and Doctorates in Nursing, and that's not in your average nursing degree.
President Dietz also reacted to your measure that would create free speech zones on college campuses. He said he has discussed this with you, and it's not an issue at Illinois State, but during yesterday's show, he did say that it's probably not a problem elsewhere either.
I think the intent and the spirit of the bill that he's supporting is a good intent, but I think we're already there, and I think a lot of other institutions are as well.
So where have you heard that this is needed in Illinois?
Well, the initial issue came from the College of DuPage, and the College of DuPage had a situation to where students were being told what they could, what they couldn't do, where they could do certain things, whether that was registering, whether that was collecting signatures, whether that was advocating for something that they believe in. And it came to a point to where it caught the attention of not only the board, the trustees with their issues that have been ongoing at College of DuPage, but also of other legislators. And across the country, we have seen in universities during the campaign season especially, what type of speakers were allowed and who was going to come speak but yet had to cancel because of objections of other groups. What this legislation seeks to do, and as a co-sponsor of it, is just to make sure that universities have in place a plan. And I think Illinois State certainly has had issues when it comes to making sure that we're as clear as we possibly can be with events that occur on the university grounds. And so I see it as a way to make sure and protect free speech. When we see free speech in some campus areas eroding for a variety of different reasons. And so it still continues to be a work in progress, but there's always room for improvement.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. We're visiting with Republican State Representative Dan Brady of Bloomington. Let's talk a little bit about politics. Although the recent municipal elections were, for the most part, nonpartisan, there were some partisan races. The normal township, which has more potential voters than the normal council or mayor's race, saw a record number of Democratic nominees, and the Dems managed to win four of five key spots, including the supervisor's race there. How should McLean County Republican leaders react to this?
Well, I think the McLean County Republican leaders should react to it as a reminder that hard work pays off. And when it comes to politics, and really when it comes to anything, hard work pays off. But I think that the political makeup of the normal township is something that should be looked at and where the vote totals were actually coming from. But Republican or Democrat, it's the reminder, it's the will of the people. and those who get out there and work very, very hard.
Are you saying the normal township is probably has more Democrats living in it than McLean County as a whole?
I'm saying if I would look at those vote totals, it's possible that in certain precincts in Normal Township, there's a heavier Democratic turnout than there was Republicans, or those that would be registered Republicans. That's one area to look at. And then, of course, what the overall turnout was, this particular municipal race, and what drove voters to the polls. And then don't ever underestimate how hard an opponent or how hard a candidate works. And certainly that's part of any type of formula when it comes to winning or losing an election.
Do you think this has to do with the blowback from the Trump election?
That's possible. I've always been one who still believes when it comes to politics, there's no substitute for hard work. And the precincts, staying in touch with people, being out amongst people, getting their feedback, good or bad. And I think there's candidates that did a very good job of that, some better than others. Some may rely on name recognition. Some may rely on I've been around for a period of time. But to rest on your laurels when it comes to politics and running for office, you can't do that. And because there's not anyone who's not beatable when it comes to a certain perfect storm, if you will. And that's something that may have occurred here in the township race.
Well, here's kind of what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. You've been in the General Assembly now, I believe, 17 years.
Correct.
And you had one Democratic opponent, your first race, and you easily defeated him. Mm-hmm. You've had no Democratic opponent since then. You did have a Green Party opponent a couple of years.
Correct.
Do you think that this coming year, 18, might be the year that Democrats put up a viable opponent against you?
You know, that's possible. I don't have that crystal ball, but being that the people have allowed me the honor to serve, beat Republicans, beat Democrats, have beaten Green Party candidates twice on occasions, I think that the electorate, even as we look in the situation they are right now, in the turmoil of what is going on in state government, while there are those that will hold you to that responsibility, that is something either of your making or something that you single-handedly can change. Others, I think, at least in my role, focus on good constituent service, someone who's accessible, someone who's down to earth, and someone who gets back to them when they have an issue. That's the other part of being representative. Very few people, when I am out and about, can tell me anything about any piece of legislation I've passed, whether it's this year or the last 17. What they can tell me is if they got a response from my office, got a response from me, we were trying to help cut the red tape of Springfield. I responded and was present at something that was important to them, their community, their village, their township, their fundraiser. The list goes on. And I think that's all something that's very, very important. That's the flip side of a representative. That's called constituent service, and that's very, very important to your constituents.
And there's no doubt that you're the poster child, really, for constituent service and retail politics. And you also have appealed to, traditionally over your career in Springfield, to traditional Democratic voting blocks and groups like unions and things like that. Do you think that is maybe the biggest reason why you really haven't had a Democratic opponent in so long?
It may be. What I try and do, Willis, is I try and put myself in other people's shoes. And why I see something one way, I try and understand how they see the issue. And that's helped. But I know how important jobs are. I know how important the trades are in our community. I know how dedicated some of those individuals are. And that's all part of trying to be, I think, maybe a little more reasonable and open-minded in some areas. And that's all part of it. When you get elected, whatever the letter is behind your name, you're still representing Democrats and or Republicans or independents or Tea Parties or Green Party or whatever. And you've got to remember that is all your constituents, whether they voted for you or not. And I've tried to keep grounded in that way, and I think it's been helpful. But there will be those who, especially with the heat of Springfield now and the problems, indicating that policy-wise, maybe I should be somebody different or doing this or doing that. But I would counter with the fact that as we continue to try and do that, Governor Reiner did not come in and create this. He inherited a lot of this. We are trying to help navigate and give the speaker and the governor ideas and resources and things that maybe they're not thinking about as we have an impasse going on. And what was done with that first stopgap budget, again, that was committees, one of which I was part of, that was rank-and-file Democrats and Republicans saying, here you go, gentlemen, we have a different idea. This will take some pressure off everybody. It was our hopes that that would have yielded into a full budget. That hasn't occurred yet, but I believe we're getting closer. And, it's very, very frustrating on all levels for all of us. But failure is not an option, so we keep working towards it.
As we look forward to 2018, there already have been some political candidates surface. Several in the Democratic race have surfaced. There have been some congressional candidates also announced their intentions. 2018 is not the year that Dan Brady is going to pack it in. You intend to run again next year?
You know, I haven't made any decisions what I'm going to do in 2018. I've been trying to stay focused on this budget mess. I really have. And I have not laid out plans. There's other offices. There's other things that are going on. I have been named as deputy Republican leader. And that has been something that has been more responsibility of trying to be in some of these negotiations and trying to bring forth with my Democratic colleagues some ideas for others who, as I said, through the governor and the speaker, who may not be thinking a certain way. And if cooler heads can prevail and find an answer and find some resolution, whether that's a full year's budget or whether that's more than just a lifeline budget, that's what we're trying to do.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Dan Brady has served in Springfield as a Republican state representative since 2001. He previously was McLean County's coroner.
Support for GLT comes from Martin's Home Furniture, presenting their new HGTV Home Design Studio by Bassett. They can help you custom design your own chair, sofa, or sectional, down to the firmness of the cushions at Martin's Home Furniture in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead, find out if you should be piling landscape waste at the curb or finding a way to reuse it. The answers are ahead during an edition of GLT's Grow. Here on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Spring has arrived in central Illinois, and farmers are headed into the fields to sow another year's crop. Their hard work and the rich agricultural history of McLean County is revealed in the latest permanent exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History in downtown Bloomington. Laura Kennedy has more.
Farming in the Great Corn Belt highlights nearly 200 years of farming in McLean County, incorporating hands-on and digital interactive installations to show just how challenging farming is in central Illinois. The exhibit is co-curated by the museum's Susan Hartzold, who worked with agriculture expert Don Meyer to bring the show to life. Over 3 years in the making, Hartzold says, in order to tell the story of farming in McLean County, the curators had to settle on what were the important themes, starting with the land itself.
What made it so rich? Why did farmers want to come here to farm? Because that's why people who settled in McLean County came here. They came to farm. Well, and of course, we have very rich land. It's affected by the glaciers. That's one of the reasons why the soil is so rich here, as well as the plants that grew here.
So as you walk into the exhibit, right to your right, we learn about what was here originally, which is all the prairie plants.
And as you can see from the model we have of prairie plants, the roots are very deep.
They are. What are those, like
five feet? 6 feet. But it's the plants and that seasonal change of growing and dying back and growing and dying back that helped to make the soil so rich. But those roots also made it very hard to plow. When farmers first came here, they didn't think the prairie was farmable. They would settle along the timbers, and they would farm the savanna areas. And the tools they were using during that time period, the moldboard plows, were made of iron, and the soil stuck to them. So it wasn't really till the steel plow was developed that turning the soil and breaking the earth for farming in the prairies became more doable. So there, that was one challenge that the farmers faced when they arrived here. The other challenge that they faced that was that a lot of McLean County was swampy.
Swampy?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So when draining technology arrived, after the railroad arrived, with lots of German immigrants, they began to tile the land, and it eliminated the swampy areas, and so that made more land available for farming.
Well, I see you have some tools here right next to these extremely long roots of the prairie plants. Are these original tools to some of the original settlers?
Yes, they are. And what this story is about is why did farmers settle on savanna? And that's because they were close to the trees, and those were all the resources that they needed to get started as farmers. So they could build buildings, they could build cabins, they had fire for making food.
So why did farmers in McLean County decide corn and soybeans were the way to go? Because we are renowned for our corn and soybeans here.
But when they arrived here, that was not the case.
Yeah.
We are definitely a two-crop system right now, but when farmers first arrived, they were doing very diverse farming. So they weren't farming soybeans. They were farming corn and oats and wheat and rye and hay. They were raising cattle and hogs and chickens and ducks because in that pioneer period, they had to be pretty self-sufficient. One of the things that we do in this particular exhibit is use technology to tell that story and to entertain people a little bit, because the rooster that's sitting in this gallery is starting to get a little annoying, so we're going to move away from him.
So now we're moving over here.
So this is a grain bin. We're about to enter our grain bin theater, where we have a video that really helps people to understand why we went from such diverse crops, the corn, the hay, the wheat, the oats, and rye, to just two crops right now, basically corn and soybeans.
And can I just say, I think it's wonderful that the seats in here to watch this video are all from tractors. So tell me how you went about organizing all of this.
Well, one of the things we wanted to do is help people to understand the changes in technology and the changes in practices and the changes in costs over time with farming. And so we approach all of those things in two different ways. One is the more direct way. So let's go back over where our rooster is crowing. We have some farming equipment.
Wow, these really go back.
Lots of information about what farmers were doing when they first came here, when they were using hand tools and horses. You can see a cultivator that's from the 19th century, as well as a small grain drill from the late 19th century, and a two-row John Deere corn planter from the early 20th century that were loaned by Funk Prairie Home. But here again, you can start to see how equipment changed over time. And if you look at our exhibit panels and the stories that we're telling with these items, it's about farmers in McLean County, but you can see that transition from hand tools to mechanization, horse-drawn equipment that the farmer could ride on, eventually to tractors and the elimination of horses.
That's why they didn't have to grow hay anymore.
That's exactly right. And on to, after World War II, really advanced equipment that allows farmers to gather lots of information while they're farming, as well as to do it more efficiently and more profitably.
Well, it's just jaw-dropping, just in 150 to 200 years, how much the technology changed.
Almost 200 years, and not only did the technology change, but the cost changed dramatically. So those are the kind of things that we're helping people to understand when they come into this exhibit. A really fun aspect in this area is a touch screen.
Yeah, speaking of
here. Technology,
you've got some really great touches.
So visitors can come in and use this to pick a crop.
Soybeans, corn,
and
hay.
And pick out whether they want to look at the equipment for planting, cultivating, or harvesting.
Let's look at soybeans.
Okay.
Okay.
And now it's showing you four videos of plowing the ground from four different time periods. So you can compare. So here we've got a farmer with a plow behind a couple horses. Then we've got a farmer with a small tractor doing a couple rows.
So technology was really important in farming, not just out in the field, but with regards to computers. Computers have changed the landscape of farming then.
Yes. So one of the things we talk about a little bit is the cost of land, and you'll see that spread out through the exhibit, you know, how expensive farmland was, because when frontier people first arrived, and after the land was surveyed, and it was, because some people came before the land had been surveyed, but once it was surveyed and they were selling the land, it was $1.25 per acre. They had to buy 160 acres and they had to pay cash, but it was a good price. Now today, farmland is much more expensive, and it comes and goes and gets higher and lower, but that's a big challenge for farmers today, especially if they're interested in getting into farming and they aren't associated with family farm. It's really hard because not only the cost of the land, but the cost of equipment.
Susan, has there been an artifact or a story that came out of your research that really delighted you or really made you learn something interesting and new?
Well, I have to admit, because my area of expertise is textiles, that one of my favorite pieces in this exhibit is Isaac Jones's go-to-town suit. Isaac Jones was a farmer in the Lilly area of Western McLean County. He arrived here in the 1820s, and he died about 1840. And this was his suit.
It looks like it's denim.
It's homespun denim, and this is what he would have worn to go to town.
So maybe that was what he would go to church in,
as well,
you know,
yeah,
that sort of
yeah.
thing.
But we also have his ox yoke.
But we don't have his ox.
That's no ox, no. I mean, but these other pieces of equipment that are featured here are from the Orndorff family, who came in 1823. So we have their plow, we have their cradle scythe, we have a grain flail for removing the seed from the harvested wheat. So one of the things we wanted to do is give some context to some of this equipment and what was going on during the time periods as well. So we're looking at the frontier period, but we also look at what happened to farming as a result of the railroad arriving here, because it had a dramatic impact. Lots of immigrants, lots of new labor coming in, lots of people who came with skills, some without skills. But these people, a lot of them got to work on the farm, and a lot of them eventually did become farmers.
Here we have some old ears of corn, and there's a couple of devices next to it, a husking pin and a corn husker's thumb protector. These are circa about the turn of the 20th century here.
Well into the 1930s and even later, farmers continued to pick their corn by hand. And in fact, it became kind of an event thing where they would have corn husking competitions in McLean County. But these are the tools that the farmers would have used to pick the corn off the stalk.
You know, I have to imagine that back then in 1900, doctors had people coming in with cases of corn husker's thumb the way people have texting thumb today.
I would imagine that is correct.
When people come to this exhibition, what do you hope people get out of it?
Oh, there are a lot of things that I really hope that visitors to this exhibit get. I really hope that they begin to see how much has changed in the last almost 200 years in farming.
Here in McLean County, we've grown up with cornfields on one side of us, soybean fields on the other side of us, but other people locating here, maybe they don't have an appreciation from larger cities about the importance of agriculture in this area.
Which is really key to this exhibit, is helping people understand that it's been going on from the beginning here, and that despite the fact that they think farmers have it easy, that is not the case, and it has never been the case. It's hard work.
That's curator Susan Hartsold from the McLean County Museum of History. Farming in the Great Corn Belt is currently on view in the museum's Franklin Family Gallery. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The farming exhibit is the third gallery to open at the museum with funding from the ongoing Extending Excellence Capital Campaign. You're listening to Luke Bryan. Here's to the farmer on Sound Ideas.
Talk about an uphill battle, 2,000 acres of beans and cattle. But he don't ever get rattled, he just goes till the sun goes down. Hydraulic fluid on his jeans, red dye diesel and 10 rows between. A cold one on the porch and a good night's sleep. Y'all hold him up with me now. Here's to the his feet with handshake of money. Here's to the farmers.
Here's to the farmer, Luke Bryan, on Sound Ideas. The agriculture sector is among many U.S. interest groups carefully watching and weighing the young Trump administration in Washington. Candidate Trump staked out ground on the North American Free Trade Agreement that could harm ag producers. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Illinois Farm Bureau Vice President David Erickson about how he and the Farm Bureau see trade developing as the Trump administration finds its footing.
Well, I think that the jury's still a bit out. I know we've heard a lot of posturing on trade, certainly by the new administration, but there's a lot of talk, you know, that went on during the campaign as well from both parties. So I think agriculture has got its work cut out for it to make sure that everybody understands how important trade is to agriculture and how important agriculture is to our trade balance.
Are there not signs that Mexico is taking the Trump rhetoric on protection to heart and seeking new agreements with places like Brazil and Argentina? Those have the potential to hurt Illinois corn and beans, don't they?
Certainly there's been some indications that, you know, that's going on. I don't think we know yet to what extent. I think what puts the U.S. in a good position to be a good trader is proximity. The fact that we are a reliable supplier, that you know, our quality on corn and soybeans is, you know, clearly world class, and we just got to make sure that we remain competitive as U.S. farmers in that world marketplace, so that we can continue to get the sales to Mexico that we've had in the past.
Commodities prices are at a 7-year low?
Yeah, they are. But maybe back more to reasonable historic levels, but certainly off the highs that we'd had.
So if the Trump administration does what the president said during the campaign he would do, which is favor manufacturing jobs over ag jobs, what will that do to farmers?
Well, again, I think it's important for U.S. agriculture, farmers of all types, all persuasions, to make sure that the administration and Congress collectively know how important trade is to U.S. agriculture. 95% of the world's population is outside U.S. borders, so certainly our marketplace is outside of our own borders. Although, you know, obviously we wouldn't be the first supplier here at home. This isn't anything really new. I think this heightens the awareness, what with current rhetoric, you know, about trade and what might happen, but also at commodity prices, whether they're grains or livestock, at a little bit lower levels than what we've experienced over the last few years.
Which is a better approach for agriculture? Bilateral trade agreements, which the Trump administration says it will seek out, or regional agreements such as TPP, which the Trump administration has rejected?
I don't think that we know yet the full impact of the lack of regional trade, because we have sort of taken the approach, at least in recent years, to take a more regional approach when you look at our trading attempts. But certainly bilateral is better than not at all. I think that maybe some bilateral trade agreements do set up a longer-term approach to regional trading groups. And the advantage that the U.S. might have in a regional trading scenario is that we can hopefully drive the narrative on trade and the issues around trade as it pertains to, you know, commodities and jobs and labor standards and those sorts of things at a wider view in the world if we do it regionally. But certainly we're not immune to having to do it bilaterally in some cases. We have in the past, and that may be what our approach has to be in the future.
The Illinois Farm Bureau is a member of the American Farm Bureau Federation, which has joined more than 100 other ag groups in a letter to the administration asking that NAFTA be modernized in a way that protects ag exports. What is the impact of Mexican trade on Illinois farmers?
You know, I don't know if I can break it down completely to Illinois, but I know that you know, when we're looking at a trade in general with Mexico, we've grown about as a country about $4 billion at the beginning of NAFTA to somewhere right around $18 billion or a little bit better in ag trade. When you look at the commodities that we grow in Illinois and you compare those to the how they rank with Mexico, we would certainly benefit greatly. They're our number one corn importer, Illinois being the number two corn-producing state. We'd certainly find that important. Soybeans, our number one importer on meal and oil, not in whole beans. I believe number two in whole beans, and Illinois being the leading soybean-producing state in the country, certainly that's a big market and a big importer. Mexico is of pork products, and Illinois is ranking in pork as well as beef production would signal that those are clearly important markets.
Canada and Mexico together account for about a third of all Illinois ag exports for the U.S., but is ag at a disadvantage in the political calculus on protectionism compared to manufacturing because there are fewer farmers than there are manufacturing workers?
Yeah, that's always been the case when we look at trade and the importance that agriculture sees in global trade. We've certainly done more than our fair share in agriculture to help the imbalance of trade. U.S. is, clearly in the negative. We import far more than we export, except in agriculture, and that's where we hold the biggest leverage. And without agriculture's positive trade balance, the U.S. would be woefully inept in our ability to trade with other partners. It's one of the key in my mind, one of the key linchpins, anyway, that keeps the U.S. competitive in the global marketplace is its agriculture production.
We're seeing a lot of uncertainty in Washington right now. A part of that is what usually happens is any new administration installs itself and picks up where the previous one left off. But is the uncertainty harmful to ag interests going forward, aside from the natural transition moment?
Negotiations that's built on long relationships and trust, and certainly in some societies, longer established relationships are much more meaningful perhaps in price and product. So I do think that if we take an approach that's less than committed, in other words, that we're not committed to the long-term relationship of our trading partners, I think it's going to have a negative impact on us. Having said that, the U.S. is, one of the most, if not the most stable economy in the world. That's why we are a sought-out trading partner. We also are a sought-out trading partner because our government in general is very stable in its approach, even through changing administrations. U.S. has been historically involved in trading agreements. We've been a leader in the World Trade Organization from the get-go, and certainly that I don't hear that commitment has wavered any. So I think it's going to be incumbent upon us again just to make sure that everyone in Washington understands the importance of trade to agriculture and why we can't be forgotten in some of these discussions to updating either current trade pacts or developing new ones.
Are there enough farm state votes to block any trade agreements that doesn't at least hold ag harmless?
Certainly the numbers aren't in our favor, but I think when you look at the overall impact that agriculture has on our trade scenario for the U.S., I think it does speak very well. I do think it's a key reason why we do need a trade ambassador specifically for agriculture like there are in other industries we have had in the past, and there's no indication that won't be the case in this administration. But I think you've got to constantly remember that even though agriculture from a voting strength is not the largest, from a trade advantage, it's clearly the leader in what we do.
Illinois Farm Bureau Vice President David Erickson speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Erickson says another key issue that needs to be fixed is the visa program for migrant workers. He says it's important to resolve after years of inaction because of tighter border control efforts. Erickson farms 3,400 acres in Knox and Henry counties near Altona. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker for Sound Ideas.
For GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Alice Lee. NPR and GLT coverage of the first 100 days of the new administration have been invaluable. Morning Edition and the Marketplace Morning Report consider and report on an international and global perspective of how the Trump administration is impacting foreign relations and international policies. With NPR and GLT, I get news over noise. Join me in helping to pay for everything GLT does. Renew your financial commitment or make a first-time contribution right now. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
If you find yourself tuning GLT in more than usual, you're not alone. Scores of listeners tell us they're more dependent on GLT than ever before for accurate, in-depth news and smart entertainment. That's a big reason why we're not interrupting programming to ask for your financial support this spring. We're just taking time in short breaks. Please help pay for everything you expect from GLT and NPR. We can't do it without your support. Contribute whatever you can right now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You can put garden waste at the curb, or you could get creative and reuse it. Patrick Murphy has the details in this edition of GLT's Grow.
We all love to save money, and there's a great tactic we should all use to do so in our landscape. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It is Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Hello, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, drying and repurposing in the garden. That sounds like a great way to save money.
It's a good way to save money, and I have noticed that in a lot of people's endeavors to domesticate their property, there seems to be some reoccurring debris that has been kind of problematic for homeowners to handle, and that's what got me thinking about this.
Okay.
And I also, I live on the edge of town, and I once tried to go into the city and discard responsibly of some landscape debris.
Right.
And I was unable to do that because I didn't meet the requirements of living in the city limits. So mm-hmm. I was stuck with about 3 or 4 wheelbarrows of leaf and clipping debris. And what am I going to do with it?
So what did you do with it?
I let it dry on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then I incorporated a technique that's called back digging or double digging. And it is similar to when you penetrate the soil with a shovel, like you're going to lift the shovel full of soil from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But you skip the last part and you don't actually lift any soil. You just open the ground up. Well, I did that in a long linear area where I had decided that this year I would plant potatoes. But I opened the ground up and I let this lawn debris, clippings, leaves, etc., dry on the ground, and nature kind of did the work after that because the little bits, the smallest bits, fell into the crevices that I created by back digging or double digging.
Yes.
And then a lot of it just kind of rested on the top after the crevices were full. And because it had dried and stayed out there all fall and winter, and now here it is spring, I hit it with a leaf rake when it was dry, and it just kind of turned in nicely with that little bit of soil on the top. And in doing so, I've eliminated all that debris, and I've added a great deal of organic matter directly to the soil.
So that's what I was going to ask. Is it healthy for the soil to be doing that?
It is, and I think it's nice because it's kind of a fibrous compost that goes in, and it allows for the penetration of air and water and the, you know, rainfall and things like that.
Right.
And That bit of fiber in the soil, in my case, because I have a tight type of timber soil, it helped a lot. But it's going to help with soil, whether you have a timber soil, black soil, yellow clay.
Yeah, I've got clayish soil myself.
All those little pieces of acorn bits and bits of branches and stuff. And but I also noticed that myself and some of my fellow gardeners had a lot of branch and tree-type debris to dispose of. And because I'm involved with a biological outdoor learning center project here at Illinois State University, mm-hmm. I came across some information about some very interesting pioneering-type techniques that are great for disposing of spent pruning.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, drying and repurposing in the garden. So what is this interesting thing?
These interesting features are called wattle. Like
W-A-T-T-L-E?
T-T, yes, okay. As in tom-tom. And I find it interesting. So I've heard of brattle work before, but I'd never heard of wattle work before.
Okay.
Well, they're actually very much alike. Brattle work is a grid made up of sticks or wood. They're very common in the modern landscape, and they're oftentimes used as fencing and screening for air conditioning compressors and other unsightly things in the landscape. Whereas the wattle is a woven fence or border or barrier or feature, whatever word you want to use. And here's how you do it, Laura.
Okay.
So I had to cut down some honeysuckle and some other unwanted woody plants. I cut those boughs and I just let them die and dry on the ground. Again, because I was not sure what I wanted to do with them. After they had dried, I had discovered this wattle technique, and about every 2 or 3 feet, you can poke the heaviest sticks into the ground.
Okay.
And then poke them in a straight line, mm-hmm. or on a curve in a straight, you know, so they're right behind each other, whatever the shape is. And then you take the other long, skinny boughs and branches, whips all, and you weave them in between these stakes.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, and you know what else I learned is, you know, shepherds and gentlemen farmers and such, they mm-hmm. use this technique and they lay rope or twine or jute on the ground first. And then after it reaches a certain size, you can just lift the rope up off the ground and tie it in a bundle and cut it off. And those can be repurposed and reused for erosion control, decoration, protection from winter elements for plants. And I'm fascinated by the look of it. It has a very artistic look.
Mm-hmm. And rustic at the same time, though.
That's right. And in certain cases, you know, so when I was reading about this and inquiring with other like-minded people, I was told that it was very common in the hedgerows of Normandy and parts of France that they would do this and then cover it with dirt and then repeat and cover it with dirt and repeat. And they developed these big hedgerows around agricultural land.
Interesting.
Similarly, I was at the DuPage College in Des Plaines, Illinois, mm-hmm. Doing some education. And I noticed on the entrance into this small campus, there was grass lining the roadways. And then right where the grass ends and the timber began, they had employed this technique. And I've talked to many people about it. The look is amazing. It helps control and clean surface water. It is friendly to wildlife. And it's attractive.
Mm-hmm.
It might even have a place in some public view landscapes, but it's certainly appropriate in the backyard, side yard, private view places. Here at Illinois State University, I want to give it a try at the Outdoor Biological Learning Center as a way to identify an area, mm-hmm. to kind of create a feature.
All right.
But I also want to do it because we have a lot of trouble with surface runoff, and there's creeks and things that way. And because it's hard to get tools and people into these areas, what a great solution to find a use for this debris on the spot, on the site, that doesn't recreate the problem, but it leaves us with a very responsible, sustainable imprint. And they have a very controllable outcome. You can make them large. You can make them small. They can appear and reappear because that whole twining technique can be used to remove it. So you might want to keep all that stuff for livestock or protecting other plants. These little bundles that look like sheaves of wheat that we've talked about, they can be laid about at the trunks of trees or over the top of ground to protect mm-hmm. it from winter exposure. It's just a great habit. And then there's the obvious stuff of collecting the stems and various pruning items that you get from trees and large woody plants, if you don't have a bucket full of stakes made up of repurposed tree limbs in your garden shed, you should.
Uh-huh.
Stakes are super handy. You can use them for just about anything.
They can hold up hollyhocks, for example.
And then I wanted to fold it into this option, too. You know, garden structures are very helpful in identifying important places in the garden. And when I say garden structures, I mean things like arbors, obelisks, little pond pedestals and things like that.
Uh-huh.
They can all be made out of repurposed wood that is created from your pruning efforts year-round.
Okay, that's some great advice there, Murph. Thank you so much. Next week on GLT's Grow, we're getting down to it, folks. It's Strawberries 101. So if you want to grow some delicious berries, better tune in. And if you've got a gardening question that you'd like Murph to take on, you got to send it to us. Go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and send it along to us. And we would love to hear from you. That's wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at our website, wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find the Sound Ideas podcast, along with the individual interviews you heard today, thanks to Laura Kennedy, Charlie Schlinker, and Willis Kern. Our website is where you can leave a comment about Sound Ideas. You can also post at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.